This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. The orangutan is an iconic primate which inhabits the rainforests of Borneo and Sumatra. Over the past several decades, however, its habitats have been encroached upon, with one of the most serious threats being the clearing of forests for all palm plantations. Joining me now to discuss the challenges facing orangutans today and also the potential paths forward is Michelle Desilet. She is the founder and executive director of the Orangutan Land Trust. She's also one of the creators of the Nyaru Men Orangutan Reintroduction Project and the founder of the Borneo Orangutan Survival Foundation UK. Welcome, Michelle. How are you today?
I'm fine. Thanks so much for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. So, you know, you've been working in orangutan conservation for over 25 years now. As I mentioned, you know, there's so many organizations that you are involved with. You are the founder and executive director of the Orangutan Land Trust. Tell me how you got into this.
Well, I actually started off as a school teacher, but I retained a love that I nurtured as a child for all primates, monkeys, apes, etc. And I would spend my school holidays going on volunteer ecotourism kind of adventures in Africa, South America. And finally, I ended up in Indonesia, where I saw my first orangutans in the wild. And they stole my heart. In fact, one little orangutan who was rescued as a pet and was very, very poorly. His name was Somalia. And he changed my life forever. Mm-hmm. He's the one that made me decide eventually, I need to give my life to this species and do everything I can to save them. And so I spent a few years volunteering during those school holidays. I remained a teacher at this project. And there I met a woman who would become my best friend, Lone Dersham Nielsen, a very famous woman knighted in her native Denmark for her work for orangutans. And she and I had this crazy idea. And she was formerly an air hostess on Scandinavian Airlines. And I, a primary school teacher, that we could do a better job of looking after orangutans and helping them return to the wild. So I went in search of the funds. Lona developed the plans and the procedures. Mm-hmm. And together, we launched the Nyaru Menteng Orangutan Reintroduction Project, which is under the Borneo Orangutan Survival Foundation, an NGO based in Indonesia. I must say Lona did 98% of the work. I was more of a sounding board, but I'd like to claim credit where I can.
Funding is no small issue.
No, it's not. It's no start. And that rescue center, which was designed for 100 orangutans, grew and grew, and more and more funds were needed for it. And it was at that point I decided to open the Borneo Orangutan Survival UK to help fund this project. And for many years, we grew and grew. But then in the, I'd say about around 2004, 2005, the oil palm started to be a problem. And I needed to shift the focus onto addressing the root causes of the decline and the displacement of these orangutans. Mm-hmm. Our center had grown from 100 orangutans to 800 orangutans, more than 800 orangutans, seemingly overnight. And while funding was still needed, what was more important for me to do at that time was to look at what was happening on the ground, why this was happening, and what we could do about it, to look at the root causes and try to come up with some long-lasting, sustainable solutions. And that's when I founded Orangutan Land Trust.
Mm-hmm. Talk to me about that. You know, those. What are these great threats for the orangutan for orangutan survival in the wild, especially?
Well, as mentioned, the expansion of oil palm into their habitat, particularly in Indonesia. Of course, the oil palm is more mature, already established in many parts of Malaysia and eastern Malaysia where the orangutans live. But in Kalimantan, where the center is located, the mid-2000s saw a real boom in the oil palm industry there. A great deal of forest cleared very quickly, and the orangutans, an obvious victim to that. Mm-hmm. It should be mentioned also that hunting itself, direct hunting, poaching of orangutans remains as much, if not more, of a problem for them as the palm oil issue. We've decided to focus primarily on the palm oil issue.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, you are, as you mentioned, like I think Little Somalia was a victim of a pet trade, wasn't he?
Yes, Somalia. Yeah, so in the early years, when we started the project, almost all of the orangutans were confiscated with the authorities alongside us from private homes or those that had been entered into the like illegal pet trade. They would end up in destinations being sold for tens of thousands of dollars in places like the Middle East or Taiwan. Mm-hmm. And so that was the original issue. And then it became that we were getting calls from villages far, far away reporting that there were large orangutans often in danger. Mm-hmm. And the rescue teams would travel for hours and go to them. And more often than not, they'd be too late. The orangutans were killed because they had entered into the newly planted estates and had done damage to the trees. Then in desperation with their forest cleared, they've nowhere else to go but to, you know, break open the young shoots of the trees and nibble on this very unnutritious source of food. And of course that means that the tree will never grow to fruition and provide fruit to be harvested, and meant a loss of profit. So the orangutan was declared an agricultural pest. Mm-hmm. And some estate managers actually put a bounty on the heads of these orangutans to their workers. And literally, the workers would come in with a head of an orangutan.
Oh, my goodness.
And get their $10 or equivalent. And so the rescue teams, I mean, I'm sorry this is graphic, but the rescue teams, when they got there, they would find orangutans butchered with machetes or riddled with air rifle pellets. We've seen them doused in petrol, set alight, drowned, beaten to death. It was horrible. Sometimes they would rescue babies whose mothers were killed in this way. Mm-hmm. So a lot of babies were coming in, having witnessed their mother's murder. And for those, they faced up to 9 or 10 years of rehabilitation in the center before they could be released. If they were a wild orangutan, then they would be brought in for treatment if they were starving or injured. And then it became a challenge to find safe places to release them.
So, I mean, how often is releasing orangutans back in the wild? I mean, is that considered an appropriate course of action? I mean, how often?
Well, yeah. The fact is that there's over 1,300 orangutans in these rescue centers. And they are being, especially Borneo Orangutan Survival and a few others, are very active in now releasing them in large numbers into safe areas of forest that are effectively protected. And again, that's a solution for those orangutans that have been rescued. But these organizations can't operate across the whole region where oil palm and wildlife come together. And so we in Orangutan Land Trust have considered that since so many orangutans do live in these regions, there was a report by Dr. Mark Aknoz of Borneo Futures that found, and Dr. Eric Maillard, I should mention, and they found that over 10,000 orangutans lived in areas allocated for industrial oil palm in Borneo alone, both Malaysia and Borneo and Kalimantan. And this says to us, well, the picking up and moving these orangutans is not really the ideal solution. That should be the last step. You know, if they're going to die if we don't move them, then we'll pick them up. But surely what we need to do is find the solutions where they're found. And in fact, they are found in these fragmented landscapes. And so that goes back to the focus of the Orangutan Land Trust is to work collaboratively with the stakeholders through platforms like the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil, the Palm Oil Innovation Group, and others to find the solutions to deliver a palm oil industry that's free from deforestation, free from wildlife extinction, and of course, all the tenets of sustainability, respecting human rights and fair wages for workers, et cetera, et cetera. It's not just about the orangutan. It's about the broad range of things. And that's been our concentration. So as you can hear, you know, there's no denying that the palm oil industry has been catastrophic for the orangutan and wildlife. Mm-hmm. But we believe that sustainable palm oil is the best solution to address that catastrophe.
Okay, and we're going to talk a bit more about that after this quick break. I'm speaking today to Michelle Desilet. She's the founder and executive director of the Orangutan Land Trust, and we're finding out more about the work she does. And as I mentioned, after this quick break, we're going to talk about sustainable palm oil. Is that a myth or is that the only way forward? You are listening to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture and I'm Juliet Jacobs. In the studio with me today is Michelle Desilet. She is the founder and executive director of the Orangutan Land Trust, and we're discussing the work that she does in rehabilitating orangutans and basically trying to protect them from the many, many threats that they face, you know, illegal poaching and also oil palm plantations. You know, that's also a big issue. So as we mentioned before the break, you know, sustainable palm oil, that is the way forward as far as you're concerned. Am I correct in saying that?
Yes, I believe so. And most any organization engaged in this issue would agree that's the way forward, yes. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, a lot of people are saying that it should just be zero deforestation. Palm oil should just be stopped. You know, it's the green cancer, I think they call it, you know. And it's very easy to get very upset and, you know, on board with that and, you know, want to boycott palm oil and things like that. So what is your view on that?
I completely sympathize with this notion. You should be outraged at what palm oil has done to the orangutan and to the planet. And a normal reaction would be to say, I want nothing to do with that. I don't want to consume this. And I was one of those people in the early years, but it's taken me some time to understand it's a very complicated issue. It's a very nuanced issue. And a boycott may not only be ineffective, it might also be counterproductive to what we're trying to achieve. So, I mean, the first thing to consider is really it's an enormous global industry. This is a very efficient and versatile oil. It's the cheapest on the market. It's the most widely used vegetable oil globally. And it's increasing as all oilseed consumption is increasing with the growing population, with rising middle classes in places like India, China, and Indonesia consuming more processed foods and fast foods. It's replaced unhealthy trans fats in many products in recent decades. So replacing the palm oil that we consume with alternative oils, the scientists have looked into this as well as organizations like ours, would result, let me go back to saying that the palm oil is the highest yielding of all these oilseed crops, meaning that if, let's say, we replaced it with an alternative crop, and that could actually lead to the need for up to 10 times as much land. Mm-hmm. And if that crop is replaced in the tropics, then we're looking at potentially 10 times as much deforestation. Can you stomach that? No. Some experts will say, okay, well, if we shift to another oilseed crop, say a temperate crop, rapeseed, for example, from Europe. Yeah. One, there's not really enough agricultural land in these regions to give it all over to this crop in order to replace the volumes that are currently satisfied by palm oil. Secondly, it would just shift the problems associated with palm oil to these other regions.
That's right.
However, what's left behind in Asia? Let's say that a global boycott really got traction and somehow we closed down the entire oil palm industry. You know, what is a $70 billion industry, if I'm not mistaken, and just shut it down completely. Now, let's just think about the millions of people whose livelihoods depend on the palm oil industry, who work in the palm oil industry as smallholders or laborers and their families. A person who previously grew rice in Indonesia and made maybe 250 euros a year per hectare on his rice is now making 10 times as much by planting oil palm. Now he can send his child to school, or if his son falls off his motorbike, he can actually send him to the hospital and he won't die. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is what we're talking about, people's lives. So that's one issue to consider, is the impact on the people if we remove palm oil from the economy. The other aspect is to ask, do you really think that the companies and the people and the governments of nations like Malaysia and Indonesia will just throw their hands up in there and go, well, okay, we can't plant oil palm, I guess we'll just live off air? Yeah. That's not going to happen. They will plant something. They will use those lands. They have an economic right to develop economically. And again, if they replace them with other crops that are lower yielding, and most of which have far lower sustainability standards, mm-hmm. you're going to see far greater impacts in these delicate and highly biodiverse regions. So that's usually the main argument I hold against having a blanket boycott of palm oil. Certainly if you know of a brand or a company that is complicit in the forest fires or human rights abuses or simply not sustainable, mm-hmm. not compliant with the RSPO's standard, yeah, go ahead and boycott them. And I'm not here to tell you what to eat or not eat or what to put on your body or not, but that's a personal choice. But what I am saying is that the boycott doesn't represent a strategy for changing what's happening on the ground. Mm-hmm. If we don't choose sustainable palm oil, who's going to grow it?
Right.
Okay? I'm a grower. I grow sustainable palm oil. No one wants it. Well, I guess I'll just go back to business as usual. And all my friends have been looking on thinking, oh, he's going to do really well because he could sell a sustainable palm oil. Oh, he's not. So I guess I won't go that route. So you know, the alternative to sustainable palm oil isn't really no palm oil. It's unsustainable palm oil.
Right. Because there's no compulsion in that sense to do
that's
it.
That's right. There's no incentive. Mm-hmm. You know, we must reward the companies that are doing the right thing. And that will provide this incentive for the wider industry to come on board. If the marketplace takes up the sustainable palm oil that's out there. And right now they're not. I mean, even the mega, you know, global multinationals who've made strong commitments for 100% certified sustainable palm oil and deforestation-free supply chains by 2020, they're not going to reach the targets. They're not delivering, and they're not picking up the sustainable palm oil that's being produced. Only about 50% of it mm-hmm. is being bought as sustainable. The rest is not sitting in vats. It's still being sold, but it's not achieving its premiums because its buyers don't care.
That's right. I mean, they are looking for probably the cheapest product yes. that they can get, yeah. right? They don't really care where it comes from. But so what, in your opinion, what does sustainable palm oil production look like? I mean, what is
well,
it?
Well, in the briefest, I mean, the standard is several pages long and several hundred indicators and principles and criteria and guidance and so forth. I helped to rewrite the standard in 2013 and 2018. 2018 was a pivotal year because we managed, just to make clear, that all the stakeholder groups worked together to develop a standard mm-hmm. and then voted into to existence and to adopt it. And so that means all the voices from growers, financial institutions, traders, retailers, consumer goods manufacturers, and the environmental and social NGOs put this document together, a set of rules about how sustainable palm oil looks, how you measure it, how you audit it, how you declare it to be sustainable. Mm-hmm. So it's very, very complex, but the basic theme is that it should be free of deforestation. There should be no peatland clearance, mm-hmm. and that should be free of exploitation of your workers, human rights, indigenous peoples, child labor, etc. Mm-hmm. That's the broadest sense of it.
Okay. And obviously you were sitting on several working groups in the RSPO, but, you know, there's been a lot of criticism targeted towards or directed towards RSPO. You know, they, like we said, there's been human rights criticism. There's been things like slow progress on implementation, those sorts of things. I mean, what would your response be to some of these general criticisms?
I think many of the criticisms are fair. So it's a bit like turning around a freighter. You know, it takes a lot of effort to make that big, wide move towards the right way. Now, one of the tenets of the RSPO has always been continuous improvement. Mm-hmm. It's recognizing where the shortcomings are and then addressing them. And you mentioned the working groups. You know, working groups, task forces, panels, advisory panels, etc., resolutions. We see something emerge. We notice that there's some issue that's not being properly addressed. And collectively, we work together to develop the solutions and find a way to implement them. Mm-hmm. And those companies that are laggards or rogues, as we might call, who are not compliant, there's a complaints system that and also an investigation monitoring unit. So even if it doesn't come into as a complaint, the investigation monitoring unit of the RSPO can look into these issues, find out what's really happening, why it's happening, and how to address it.
Sure.
So I think we need to be fair that this is a voluntary platform, and its value is only as that of its members.
Sure.
And when regrettably, when a member has been non-compliant, it tends to tar the entire institution or platform and all of its 4,300 members, including the NGOs like us who are fighting so hard to put it right.
Yeah.
And I say, please, you know, support the efforts of these dedicated and committed individuals working tirelessly. I mean, the work I do with RSPO on all of these working groups and panels is purely voluntary, as it is for everyone. There's no remuneration for the work we do.
Mm-hmm.
It's because we really believe that this is the way forward. So back to your reports. Yes, there is some truth in them, sometimes not all true. And that takes some further investigation to figure out where the truth lies.
Okay. Would you say it's, I mean, because always there's that argument of there needs to be a balance between economic gains and preserving the forests, right? And do you think that is something that is possible?
Well, yes, I of course I do. Under the RSPO, deforestation is prohibited. But that doesn't mean that the industry can't continue to improve and grow, even expand if it must. Of course, one of the features of sustainability is trying to increase the yields in the already established plantations.
That's right.
Making better use of those areas through stronger seedlings and R&D and so forth, and enabling smallholders access to those strong seedlings and the R&D to allow them to be part of the solution. Now, remember, smallholders make up 40% of the global supply chain, mm-hmm. so they must be included in the equation. But it's also possible in for example, in Borneo, the World Resources Institute, several years ago, identified over 14 million hectares of non-forested areas mm-hmm. suitable for the expansion of palm oil. Wow. So there's absolutely no excuse to go into forested areas.
That's right.
And still develop your economy. It becomes a little trickier when you go into high forest cover countries where perhaps there needs to be a little bit more compromise. A certain lower quality scrub forest might have to be considered. This is a very technical discussion being looked at by the high carbon stock approach mm-hmm. team and the RSPO. How do we deal in those areas? But in places like Malaysia and Indonesia, it's very clear under the high carbon stock approach, which not only looks at carbon stock, despite its name, it also looks at communities and biodiversity, et cetera, ecosystem services. By using this approach, we can determine which areas are no-go and mm-hmm. which areas can be exploited, and thereby protecting the forest.
You know, I was reading the Norwegian University of Life Sciences. They stated that oil palm is alternatively seen as a gift from God or a crime against humanity. And according to science, it is neither. But can you unpack that statement for me, and especially with regard to orangutan conservation?
Well, yeah, I think they've captured the polarization of the issue.
Yes.
Okay. The Malaysian government have called it the gift of nature or something like this,
along those lines,
some years ago, and have made some interesting comments about how it benefits the orangutan by giving them shiny red hair. But despite that, let's go back to science.
Let's
okay?
go back to science. Yes.
So, yes, it's neither a green gift. It's a gift for millions of people if it's done properly. It's always with that caveat that it's done properly. It's done sustainably according to the standards of the RSPO or equivalent. And that means respecting the rights of the communities and indigenous peoples in the areas that oil palm is developed, respecting the rights of women, children, and workers, et cetera. So in that way, it is indeed a gift mm-hmm. for millions of people. And on the other hand, it cannot be denied that there are significant impacts associated with unsustainable palm oil. That's the other side of the equation. But the answer lies somewhere in the middle. Mm-hmm. And we believe through the use of science, understanding where the impacts are, what's driving them, how they can be modified or mitigated, mm-hmm. I think we can find the way forward. We developed a platform called the Pongo Alliance a couple of years ago. The Pongo is actually the Latin name for orangutan.
Orangutans, yeah.
And Pongo also is an acronym for Palm Oil and NGO Alliance. So it's a group of some of the biggest growers, such as Sime Darby here in Malaysia, and NGOs and scientific experts who are looking at making resilient landscapes for wildlife and people. Mm-hmm. So working in the Kinabatangan region in Sabah, where you find both the elephants and orangutans of countless other wildlife. It's a bountiful paradise for wildlife, but it's also terribly fragmented by oil palm. And developing corridors in these areas for the wildlife to roam freely. Wildlife needs space to move and to breed. It needs food, and it needs to not be killed. These are the three tenets for protecting wildlife in oil palm landscapes. So working with the companies to make these landscapes possible, to put in the activities such as planting enhancing fruiting trees, connecting up fragments of forest, working with communities so that they don't encroach or hunt these species, so forth. These solutions can be found through collaboration and through science and measuring the impacts. Then they can be used as pilots or incentives to encourage these kinds of activities across the world and other biodiversity regions, working with other commodities, pulp and paper in Sumatra or rubber in Sri Lanka or whatever it might be. Mm. It's changing the shift of thinking from development and biodiversity cannot coexist to they must coexist and we must do all we can to ensure that they coexist.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, on that note, what do you believe the role of education and outreach are in, you know, especially in orangutan conservation and, you know, building this bridge between economic development and, you know, maintaining our forests?
Well, I mean, you've hit on a big part of our work. We're working with zoos around the world and schools around the world to do this outreach, to tell them the story that sustainable palm oil can provide benefits is the thing to look for. I looked to Chester Zoo in the UK. Have done remarkable work. And they've engaged, not only their visitors who come to the zoo, but they've also gone out to dozens of schools in the region, engaged with the students and the teachers there. And in fact, they created the world's first sustainable palm oil city in the city of Chester. And by this, I mean that they came up with a benchmark of there'd be X number of universities and schools that would make a commitment to sourcing sustainable palm oil, restaurants, other institutions, companies, retailers, etc. And once all of these companies had audited their supplies and shown that they are truly sourcing sustainable palm oil, mm-hmm. committed to sustainable palm oil, they were awarded the first sustainable palm oil city.
Oh, wow.
Now, I challenge Kuala Lumpur to be the first Asian sustainable palm oil city. There's other cities coming on board around the world, especially in the UK, across Europe. And I'm sorry to say, but I've been having discussions with colleagues and organizations and companies in Singapore who are making noises about being the first Asian sustainable palm oil city. So
I think the challenge
has started here. So we'd really encourage not only consumers, but your listeners who maybe represent companies in the supply chain to come on board, make their commitment. Just put your toes in the water, learn about sustainable palm oil, make a commitment to audit your supply chain and to ensure that whatever your supply chain is, to ensure that's free from deforestation, free from wildlife extinction, free from human exploitation.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I imagine that the social media, digital media, you know, that plays an important role in this as well. I mean, how important is that in the work that you do?
I'm quite famous for our social media. We've been told that we're a major influence in the discourse on sustainable palm oil and biodiversity. And I've seen it shift minds, not only of consumers. Last night or the night before in the UK, another program on orangutans and palm oil aired, and the angry response is, I'm going to throw out all of my products in my pantry because they all contain palm oil. And my intervention to say, there might be another way of thinking about this, has got people thinking and changing. Yeah. But more importantly, it's when the retailers and the brands are hearing this message. And what I'm seeing is more and more consumers tweeting, writing messages on Facebook pages of these companies saying, hey, I like your product, but I don't know if you're using sustainable palm oil. Can you tell me more? Mm-hmm. I expect that what I buy, what I consume, is not tainted with mm-hmm. deforestation. So this kind of engagement, and then I work with the retailers. I work with groups like the Sustainable Palm Oil Choice. Have a look at our website for that, trying to drive the uptake of sustainable palm oil in the EU and worldwide. Retailers and manufacturers are telling me that they're starting to get more and more feedback that the consumer is demanding sustainability. They're moving away from the boycott, and that's what we'd like to see. And they're responding to those demands. They're saying, we need to up our game and make sure all of our supply is sustainable.
So demanding accountability as well.
Exactly. Traceability. And that goes right the way up to the supply chain and is a tool to deliver the assurance that the marketplace needs. Okay, so I go back to Sime Darby, a leading company in sustainable palm oil here in Malaysia. And they have a program called CrossCheck, which allows you to understand, to see quite transparently the supply chain, where your palm oil is coming from, and be assured that if any issues do arise, that the company is there on the ground ready to react to it.
All right. I'm afraid we're running out of time, but, you know, what would your advice be to, you know, anyone listening, you know, and they want to contribute to orangutan conservation? I mean, are there some methods that are more effective, perhaps, in your opinion?
I think one of the most effective is, just as I discussed, making that communication and doing what you can to ensure that you're not part of the problem, but you're part of the solution in demanding sustainable products. Certainly, we need funds to help us do our work, not only to do our work in driving this agenda of sustainable palm oil, but also to support the many necessary conservation activities on the ground. And we rely on what we call sustainability partners with progressive companies, that we have a shared vision of sustainability, and some funding will go directly to our partners working on the ground to fight forest fires or to prevent them, to release rescued orangutans, to work with communities on alternative livelihoods, to develop corridors. These are some very productive ways that we can really help what's happening on the ground.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay. And, you know, if anyone would like to get in touch, I think your website is forestfororangutans.org.
That's right. With the four is the number four.
The numerical four. All right. Yes. Thank you so much for joining me today. I've been speaking to Michelle Desilet. She's the founder and executive director of the Orangutan Land Trust. And we were discussing her work in orangutan conservation and rehabilitation. And if you miss any part of this interview or any previous Earth Matters interviews, you can search for the podcast on our BFM app, available on Google Play, the App Store, and also on Spotify. This has been Earth Matters on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.